put it this way, we were not ready to go World Superbike racing. You know, the old setup wasn't ready, and then he smashes his finger up. So he's out straight away. So then we've got Brooksy in. You are Japanese, you are warrior sort of thing to him. You know, I said, no crying. And to be honest, I would have raved for sacking him anyway, because he just never turned up.
What are your favourite memories of being out at Macau?
Going to Thailand after.
Is that the way?
Hello and welcome to Off Track, the motorcycle racing podcast. If you're new to the show, I'm your host, Dave Neal, and thank you for finding us. I'm really glad you're here. If you're not a new listener, then welcome back. It's great to know you're enjoying what we do. This week, we return to Milnrow, just outside Rochdale, to catch up with the evergreen Jack Valentine. It's 12 months since we sat down with Jack for our maiden video podcast, and we thought it was time we did another show with the great man, this time covering his time in World Superbikes and a little bit more on his love for the TT. We're working really hard to make 2024 even better than last year, and hopefully we can make that happen together. Links to our Patreon page, merchandise, and our social media links are in the description below, so please check those out while you're there. Thank you. Now let's get into it. This is Jack Valentine.
Jack, welcome back to the show. Great to see you again.
Yeah, thanks good to see you, Dave. Yeah.
It's been a year since we did that last one. How time's flown.
Certainly does, yeah.
It's been ridiculous. What have you been up to over the last 12 months?
Oh, I've been playing plenty of golf. I sort of filled a little bit of a void when I'm missing from racing, because I do miss racing. Mm. I do miss racing, and I think I said before, but when you've been at a certain level, I don't just want to be, you know, knocking around in a paddock for the sake of it, you know, because I like the outdoors, I like my golf and stuff. So, yeah, been winning a few comps in golf for a change.
Excellent. You're still winning then. That's a good thing.
Yeah,
that never
well,
leaves
it's,
you,
it's
does
still
it?
There. You know, if you've been involved with racing, or any of the lads in racing will tell you that, whatever they do, whether it's going for a cycle ride or whatever, if they're always trying to beat whoever they're with, aren't they? And it's just sort of one of them things, isn't it?
It's like when they're out cycling, they're always half-wheeling somebody, aren't they? They're always trying to push that little bit more, And it's just you and I for this chat. Ben, he's busy getting ready to go out to Spain and do a couple of bits out there, ready to defend his Super Sport Championship.
Yeah, good year he had.
He did have a good year. Proud of him. I think he's not going to have it quite all his own way this coming season. I think there's a few rule changes. There's some strong riders on some strong bikes and a couple more Ducatis into the mix as well. So he'll do well to retain it this year.
It's good to see the Super Sport series being refreshed, you know, because it just died. I mean, there was just a few, R6 Cup almost, wasn't it?
Yeah.
If you wanted the bike to win consistently, you had to be on an R6. And now, I think is it 750 triples in from Triumph?
Yeah, the Triumph 750 triple,
The Dukes and stuff. And yeah, it's good.
Well, Luke Stapleford on that Triumph will be quick.
You know
what he can do on a Triumph.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to seeing Super Sport this year. That's going to be fun. And so is BSB as well. I think it's, I reckon it could be the most open championship in a few years.
The
sad loss of Birdie, you gone head to head with Birdie a few times over the years. What are your abiding memories of Paul?
Just a real sort of passionate guy about motorsport, full stop. In particular, his bike racing, and real like northern character as well. You know, he always called it his little team from up north. You know, but I mean, he put a hell of a lot of his own money in the job, and it's just a passion he had. And in our game, there's a hell of a lot who think they could just come in and just sort of buy into it. But as soon as the money starts, you know, getting a little bit out of hand, because you've got to have a big budget to do what Paul does and to run at that level. It's not just a matter of, thinking, right, I've got this, I've got these bikes, got that, get the top rider on it. It doesn't work like that. You've got to have that team. It's got to be that like sort of family atmosphere almost. And Paul did that, you know, so that's why he was successful.
I think was it Sean Muir that coined the phrase, how do you make a small fortune from racing? You start with a large one.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not an easy sport to come into. You know that. You spent many years.
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't change anything, but I went right from when I started my own like bit of club racing and into the obviously the drag racing, which we've been into before. But all I wanted to do was racing. I wasn't bothered about anything else. Just racing. I wasn't bothered about, you know, you had to earn a bit of money to live, like a wage. You've got to have something to live on. But that wasn't the motive. That was not the motive. All I wanted to do was go racing.
And what a success you made of it. We spoke about it at great length in the last show we did last year.
Yeah.
But one thing we didn't cover off, because we sort of keep an eye on the time, and like you said before, we're like, hang on a minute, we're 2.5 hours in. Where did that go?
Yeah.
Because once you start with the stories and once you start going back through and you go, and as we've done with Charlie Williams, you go, and this leads to this and this. Oh, and then we did this and then we did that. And it's just a brilliant way to do it. And yeah. So if we could have a recap of the World Superbike years, because that was something we missed out on, but it's an integral part of your management time.
Yeah, I mean, strange how I got into that, because I just finished when I brought Triumph back to racing in 2003. I went in 2003 and 2004. And then when that contract finished and there'd been a big change in management at Triumph or whatever, they didn't want to go racing again because they were working on the 675 at the time. And we put quite a bit of input into that, actually, because I was looking forward to hopefully racing that. But anyway, that was sort of history. But I didn't actually have anything on the cards at the time. And we had we'd had some contact with the management of Carl's team in Patronus when they were setting it up. Murray, the CEO, and another guy came around to our place just having a look, you know, to see, you know, how things, you know, in a workshop, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, obviously they had a massive budget and they were just looking at, you know, setting up. And so there was a little bit of contact there. And when we finished with the Triumph contract, he'd been on to me, Murray. He'd said, you know, do you know anybody who might want to, I need a crew chief basically for the following season, the 2005 season. I said, nah, I said, keep my ears up, mate. You know, but I couldn't think of anybody really suitable because all the ones who I would have, you know, advised him on were already in jobs. And then as nothing was happening, as it came into, I think it was like January or something like that, I thought, there's nothing happening here at the moment. I thought, I'll give Murray a shout. I just say, you get fixed up with the crew chief. I said, because I'm not sort of doing anything at the moment. I've just finished this Triumph contract. And I said, you know, I don't mind getting back onto that because I knew the setup, what they had. They had all the data technician, they had the suspension, etc. So it wasn't like, you know, I'd be trying to do everything.
Yeah.
You know, they were already at a very high standard. So he said, yeah, come down, well, let's have a chat. So I get down there and he said, we've just been having a chat down here. What do you think about running it as a team manager? So I said, all right. So he said, no, we haven't had a team manager. They haven't had a team manager for over a year. They got rid of the original team manager and they'd run without a team manager for a year. So I said, I couldn't believe it. You know, I would have thought, maybe Patronus would have been saying, who's running this, you know?
For the finance that was behind it.
Yeah, I mean, they had a lot of higher management, you know, like a almost like a big company, CEO, financial manager, you know, PA, all a lot, but no team manager. So I said, yeah, well, fine. So that's how it started. And I'm going to admit, I thoroughly enjoyed that job. It was tough. But I was a proper team manager. I had the technical budget and my job was a proper team manager, not running around doing other things, booking flights and hotels or anything like that. Just focused on the job. I had a budget, worked my budget out, looked at what we needed, looked after my team. And it was good. That's how it started. And, you know, first thing I did, I went in there, I went to have a look at what they had. And they were having the change engine builders as well at the time. It was originally a Swiss company called Suter. Eskil Suter was building the bikes and they'd had lots of issues or whatever. And for whatever reason, decided to bring it into the UK. And that was Ricardo Engineering down at Shoreham.
Yeah.
So I look at the bikes and chassis had like dents in, and there was a lot of scruffiness of the bike, you know, and I was questioning the guys. And they said, oh, we've been told, you know, until they get the engines right, they're not spending anything else on chassis.
Wow.
So obviously, I've got a budget anyway. So I said, right, we're getting some new frames, new swinging arms. The electronics were way behind. They were using an old system which had been used on the Ducatis back in that era. But they couldn't control like engine braking and other areas. But they were actually looking at all different systems. But again, budget came into it. So, you know, that was another area which I started to look into. And we got all the bikes, you know, I said, I want all of the chassis, all the bikes, absolutely immaculate. I said, then we'll deal with the engines from there, you know. So that perked the team up. There was a lot of, you know, it motivated everybody. And so that's how we started, you know, and then it sort of went from there. I could go on and on and on about it, you know, because then you start with the engines. But that's how I got into it. And, yeah, went from there, a real professional team. Good budget, good test program. Yeah, good years, very, very challenging, but really good years, you know.
Challenging in what way?
Because one of the biggest problems was when they first worked on that design of engine, a 900 triple, that was against 754s.
Yeah.
Now, a 900 triple working well should really beat them. Beat the 754s and be certainly competitive with the 1000 twins at the time, which were Ducatis. But by the time the project had started and got moving, when they did eventually come on track, the FIM had changed to 1004s. So they'd not even really got started, no. And they'd been bang hit with the 1004s, and then you're playing massive catch-up. And I do think if it had stayed 754s and we could have got a grip on the engine reliability, et cetera, and the other issues which we might come on to, they would have been competitive. But you've no chance. So they're on the back foot all the time.
See, it was a huge undertaking, wasn't it? When you look back at it for a brand new motorcycle from the ground up,
yeah,
to go racing at world superbike level with, yeah, with Foggy as the figurehead,
yeah,
and all the money of Petronas and the colour and the pomp and circumstance that came with it, I don't think it can be underestimated just how big a challenge and just how big a project it was.
It was a fantastic project. I mean, the workshops, everything was to the highest standard, you know. There won't be many places like that even now. I mean, probably, you know, obviously your major teams like Ducati and that in Grand Prix, that's a different level. But at the time, the workshops were, we had an engineering section, we could get all the trucks into the workshops. We had, you know, like a proper, well, simple things like the proper reception area with a girl on reception who dealt with that. We had, I had my office, the Malaysians had an office. I know it sounds a little bit over the top, but it wasn't, because everybody was working, you know, as a team. And it was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. We had our own dyno in there, everything, fabrication area. Absolutely first class.
Who did you have as riders? Steve Martin and...
When I came in, we had Steve Martin and Gary McCoy.
Gary McCoy, that was it.
Yeah.
That was your one.
That was the riders I came into. I mean, Gary... well, they were both great. Two totally different characters. Gary was, you know, I mean, the bike did suffer from an engine braking issue. It just had too much... it's like flywheel effect, really. It was, as you shut off, the back end just almost instantly came round.
Okay.
And it was trying to, and then the electronics, they couldn't sort that out. So, I mean, Gary was just going in completely broadside, but losing so much speed, and the engine didn't have enough torque then to drive out. You know, but Steve, Steve put a lot of work in. I mean, he was great to work with, Steve, one of the best riders I've ever worked with.
That's a high accolade, considering some of the riders that you've worked with. That puts him right up there.
It was great, especially in the second year, because that's when we had Craig Jones came on. But you know, that's another little story. But went the second year and Steve re-signed, and he knew things weren't really going to get any better. And it could also, it was also the last year of the contract as well. But that's another thing I felt quite proud of, because Steve appreciated the team and the effort we was putting in for him. And the little details, you know, we might make the tank a little bit narrower for him to get, you know, get in under the cockpit or get a little bit, you know, neater on the bike to help him get a bit of speed or whatever. We're doing all sorts of little things to give him the best we could. And sometimes he'd qualify it on the front row, but he couldn't race it, because if you got a bad start, or you got the start and then the others are just compassion, unless you're on perfect classic racing line, you've no chance.
You're just making yourself as wide as possible.
Yeah. It's just
the inevitable. It's
come on the straight, everybody just went bang, you know. It was horrible, man, because that's when Biaggi was on the Aprilias as well.
Oh, right, so that's...
And they just could pass you, like you're going backwards, you know.
It's similar now to Bautista on the Ducati, isn't it? It's
a little bit like that,
It's a small man on a very, very powerful motorcycle.
Well, I mean, the frustrating thing really was, with that project, was the engines, and I think that was the frustrating problem right from the word go with it, you know, because they fell out with Suter for whatever reason, and then went with Ricciardo. Now, in hindsight, I'd have probably enjoyed working more with Suter than Ricciardo, because Suter knows motorcycles.
He's a motorcycle engineer, yeah.
But like where Ricciardo are a top like engineering company and development company, but not really motorcycles. So trying to get through to them what we wanted out of that engine. And I mean, they had a separate budget, you see, because that was, Petronas had basically told them to get 200 horsepower out of a 900 triple. So that's all they focused on, the 200 horsepower, nothing below, nothing, not the power curve, just that figure.
Just get to that figure.
That's the contract, the delivered rate, basically.
Isn't the essence of motorcycle racing how you get to that 200 horsepower?
Yeah, and I showed them that when I took a stock GSXR 1100 and we put it on the dyno and put that on. Okay, the FP1 was quicker at the top, but the torque spread and the power curve, that's what we want. That is what we want. Only we do a top end and then we might get somewhere.
Did it have an issue? Do I remember? Was there an issue with oil pressure or oil return or something like that?
Basically, fluid retention.
Yeah, fluid retention. Generally speaking.
Yeah. I mean, it really got to me that, and I mean, that's. I think the lads who you know my team appreciated that because I was on the case with it all the time. I wouldn't let it drop. I mean, there's cases where we would have a brand new engine sent up in a flight case from Ricciardo.
Yeah.
Open the flight case and there'd be oil in the flight case. So it's already leaking before it's even in the bike. So it was like on the phone, can you send us another engine up, please? Well, we've sent you one. Yeah, I know it's just arrived, but the flight case is full of oil. It's already leaking. Well, it wasn't leaking oil on the dyno. Well, it's leaking oil now. Send them the photographs. No. Send another one up. And all we could do, the only thing we could do was change the gearbox, the ratios in the gearbox. It had a cassette gearbox and the clutch. We couldn't touch the other parts of the engine. We couldn't take covers off or anything. That was their job.
Wow.
Because they should basically, in theory, should work really well. It's like Ducati, you know, the satellite team, get an engine from Ducati, or even, well, like I said, Birdie, when he was running in British Superbike, engine comes in from Ducati, straight in the bike, and away we go. You know?
For a refresh, send it back, no problem.
Yeah. But no, it was oil leaks. They had a dry clutch system on the bike, which then there's a seal in the cases, which obviously stops any engine oil coming through into the dry clutch. That was always leaking. There's lots of design faults. And, you know, you sort of look at that and you think, well, just looking at that, say the clutch goes on, was really long, and it was basically there was flex. So it was flexing, letting the oil through the seal.
Which allowed the leak to come through, the oil to come through the seal.
So, you know, wow. It was little things like that what I was really adamant needed sorting. And then they made some different seals there. So, like, I forget how it was, maybe like triple lipped or something like that. I know it quite a costly seal. That sort of cured that. But then there's still lots of little issues. We used to, many times we'd go out on the track and in the belly pan, there'd be all like a thick sort of like absorbent material we'd put in just in case there was a little bit of a leak. So that was a constant battle. The other thing being the design of the exhaust system, which was a beautiful piece of pipework because the cylinder head was like reversed so that the pipes came out normally where your carbs would be or your injectors. Because I think that was down to an initial design of the road bike. As I know, Carl wanted to keep it really slim, like a Ducati with the pipes all hidden and et cetera. So they obviously designed it that way, where the headers came under the seat, basically, and into the silencers at the back. And it was beautiful. But Micron built it all, nice silencers all tucked in. But there was no major energy loss in the exhaust gases. So when they were getting to the silencer, you're talking, well, shorter than the length of that coffee table.
Yeah.
So everything's mad hot. It's the silencers. So then you've got, I didn't actually have that problem because I'd gone to titanium silencers when I got there. But previous to me coming, they were having fires, like at Monza. And places like that, the seat unit's on fire and stuff like that, you know. But he couldn't really alter it, but because if, I don't know, I mean, I'd love to have been involved right from the start.
Yeah.
But it would have been a major operation to try and change that, because obviously you've got the engine people building the engine. And I mean, unless you say, right, we're finishing this project, build a new engine with a new...
Let's sit down and do this from the start.
Yeah. If we're going to beat the 1004s, we need a rethink.
Yeah.
So we spent a lot of time on that. And in the end, you've got your seat unit again, which was a beautiful structure. It was a carbon fibre with the seat rails, and it was part of the actual chassis, really. We were suffering a lot of chatter on the bike. Couldn't get rid of it. So we went on. It was at Lautzitring. I remember it clearly. I was out with Ken Summerfield from K-Tech. He popped out with us at the time. Even though we were running Orleans, that was as Ken was getting into. He hadn't gone with Orleans with his own business fully at the time. And we were out there looking, and we were watching in certain corners where they were experiencing it, and you could see the seat like unit flexing like. Hell, you know, it's shaking. What's going on there? So we said, I bet that's what's causing it.
Yeah.
So when we got back, the seat was flexible and it all started to click because of this heat in the silencer box at the back. It's basically delaminating slowly the carbon.
So it's becoming more and more flexible.
So we hastily just got some sheet metal and we popped riveted a load of... strengthening bits in it, sent them out cured.
Wow.
Just like that.
Something, when you look back, it's so fairly simple.
Yeah, very simple. That's just a flaw in the design, with the exhaust system. But it's still, even if we'd cured all that, you've still got the problems there with the engine not making enough power and still depositing oil every now and again, we were changing engines sometimes in after warm up before the race,
which that's the worst time to do it.
Crazy boys work so hard, and I mean, like I said, when I came into the team, they were so demotivated, you know. I mean, they were all happy because they were in a good environment working-wise, and they were all on, you know, pretty decent salaries for that time of year, you know, that year. But they were definitely demoralised, but, you know, the amount of work they put in was just ridiculous, you know.
If you had that, if you wind the clock back, if you had that decision again and that question again, will you come and be team manager? Would you still take it?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. I loved it. It was a fabulous challenge because I had the budget to work with,
sure,
to try and improve things,
which is so important because you don't 100%. Often get that in a lot of teams.
No.
Where you know we can't spend this, yeah, we can't spend, we've got to keep that. But yeah, it wasn't an all costs project, but it was a comfortable. I was speaking to James Hayden last week, and he said even they paid him not to race for a year,
yeah,
because the bike wasn't ready,
yeah.
And he's like, well, okay, but he couldn't ride anything else,
yeah.
Tell me about bringing Craig on board because I have a
well. What had actually happened at the end of 2005 then, Gary McCoy, I think he just went off to do other things, if I remember rightly. Or certainly, I can't remember the reason, but they didn't renew his contract anyway. But we renewed Steve's contract because he really was 100% behind the project as well. So they needed somebody else. And obviously then, it's the last year. You could sense it's the last year. So, not that any top rider would have probably come and rode the bike anyway, unless he maybe, I don't know, been out injured or whatever, and he couldn't get a seat anywhere else, and they'd have had to pay big money to get him.
Yeah.
You know, we were just discussing a few things, and like Carl said, he says, there's no good like young British rider I'd like to put somebody like that on, you know. So hence Craig. And yeah, it was good, very good. It was good for Craig too. He learned all the circuits. He quite often he was battling with Josh Brooks at the back of the field, and Josh was on a privateer Kawasaki at the time, yeah.
Good grief.
You end up with them two having a bit of a ding-dong right at the back of the field, yeah. So and it sort of brought Craig on. It sort of really matured Craig for him. Then when he went into Supersport after, didn't he?
Didn't he? PTR and Park Algar.
Yeah.
A brilliant job. But
yeah.
With Brains last week, I know Brian how much love Brains had for Craig.
Yeah.
As we all did. Such a great kid. I love to make sure that wherever the chance is, that we don't forget about him.
And we talk about him
on the podcast wherever we can.
Yeah.
Because it's important.
Yeah.
It's important.
Well, I'm going back to the Triumph when he first had me. He was totally green. I mean, he rode motorbikes, but he didn't know anything. You know, like say like this podcast now or interviews. He was so shy and he was just lovely to watch him develop, not only as a rider but as a person as well.
He was great. The last I saw of him was at the XL bike show. I forget what year it was. Off the top of my head.
Yeah.
And we were just sat in the corner talking. He's like, Dave, I've got to go. I've got to get my train. And I remember seeing him run away across the concourse. But he'd had some big crashes in his time, hadn't he? That big one at Alton Park Junior Superstock.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he broke both his legs.
Yeah, that's when we picked him up after that with the Triumph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we've seen Donington Park and the Triumph win and everything else. It's so important that we talk about him, especially with a smile, because he was one of the first riders when I first sort of started coming into the paddock a little bit more that I actually got to know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that'll always be important to watch that.
Well, that era as well, because you had Cal Crutchlow, Sykesy,
Leon
Jonesy,
Cameo,
Johnny Ray and all them. They were like, you know, was that
MLAV was in there. There was a few, weren't there?
Yeah, there were one or two. And they all went on to do great things, you know. Craig would have done the same, you know. Not a question at all.
Because when you look back, and I look back at that fondly at sort of the late noughties, whatever they call them.
Yeah.
When sort of Johnny went off to Worlds, Cal went off to World Supersport. And it was that golden era, wasn't it? And it just doesn't seem to, it's not there anymore.
No, I think it goes in swings and roundabouts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It'll come back.
Things have changed a lot with BSB, haven't they, with the regulations and things like that. So I kind of see BSB sometimes as difficult to come into, but it's also kind of difficult to leave as well. With in terms
it is,
of
yeah,
I mean to look at how Brad and Taz have had to adjust going to World Superbikes with the electronics and things.
Yeah.
You need two seasons wherever you go. Yeah. Rory at Moto2.
It's not easy.
You need two seasons everywhere.
I mean, going back to that when with Tom Sykes, when I had Tom when I was running the Suzuki team in, I just come into that team in beginning end of '07, but ready for the '08 season.
Yeah.
And we had Tom and Watanabe. And we had some good wild cards with him. And that's what, after that season, Yamaha picked him up.
And then all of a sudden he was world champion.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously moved on from Yamaha. It was unfortunate for Tom, really, because they wouldn't let him take his English crew chief with him.
Right.
He was just with Yamaha with the Italians. And Tom's, well, you know Tom, he's a real character, typical Yorkshireman. He's a funny guy, and Ben Spees was there, so it was all Ben Spees, and Tom was, you know, just pushed back a bit, probably not being strong enough character at the time neither to push himself, so he got him on the world stage, and he obviously was world champion at a later date, wasn't he? You know?
Exactly. So interesting to see what he does this
year. Work with those guys, you know.
It's so good that you look back on those times with the fondness as well.
Yeah.
And having the presence at the time to just sit there and go, this is so good.
Yeah.
Working with these individual riders, there's always going to be the odd difficult one thrown in because it's the nature of the sport.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, I think you've been in the riders that you've chosen to work with, you've picked the right ones.
Yeah,
in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I mean, it's been all little blitz, but I wouldn't say anything, nothing really major. I mean, you know, it's sometimes a rider will go through a bad season. I mean, we had that with Glenn Irwin. Yeah. There's a lot of problems on his own side, which I'm sure he would admit, you know. But it's just what happens. It's just what happens, you know.
They're a rare old breed, aren't they?
Oh.
Riders.
Certainly are. But I've been fortunate that, like I said, you know, the ones I've worked with, I've enjoyed working with them all, you know.
So, Mick, carrying on with the World Superbike story, when was that then with Crescent?
Yeah, we finished the Petronas one ended, and it was a shame, really, that one. Just like a touch on that, because we had the Ducatis lined up to carry on the following year. And they were working on sponsorship for it. And this is where I think sometimes, even though it was a great structure, what we had there, I think, I hope Carl don't mind me saying it, but I think it was being mainly run by the CEO and the financial guys.
Funny you say that, just as an interject, sorry. But I was with James Hayden last week. And James, at the point, a point he made was that when he went to ask Carl for help, Carl was kind of like, "It's not me. I'm just a figurehead.
Yeah,
I don't make the decisions." Yeah. Just to back up that point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I sussed that straight away, and I mean, obviously they'd have been on good money as well. So it's, you know, so I think Carl, if he, I can understand Carl maybe not wanting to put his own money in because, I mean, he's risked his life all those years and achieved and et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's my view was that they could have run. I don't know fully, but I would think there'd have been a little bit left in the kitty where they could have run maybe for a season.
Yeah.
But those who were running it on the board of the they might not have been able to take the money what they might have been on. That's my own personal view. It's like we've had what was a deal? I think it was a big deal. I forget. I won't quote figures because it was a big deal at the time.
Yes.
And they have obviously been paid accordingly to that deal. And to, you know, this is where the passion then comes in. I think if somebody could have guided it, even if just let's just try it for 1 year. If it doesn't work, we've got enough to run 1 year. Yeah. Let's just let's just have a go. And I think it would have kept going then, because it would have picked the sponsor up.
Even if it was just one rider, one bike.
But if you're going to try and get a sponsor on the same terms as you've had with somebody as big as Petronas,
you're going to be disappointed, aren't you?
Very, very. Because that had an add-on to it, that they was going to build their road bikes.
Yes.
I mean, that's another separate story. We weren't involved with that at all. But that was it was like a project for Petronas in Malaysia. You know,
because he'd have to build, was it 100 or 150 for homologation, something like that?
I mean, it got fiddled around. I mean, they had 150 chassis and that, but they never had, they've started appearing here and there. I mean, they did get built eventually, but there were so many issues.
Yeah.
But obviously the FIM had probably just let it run its course because they needed manufacturers in and throughout the series, you know.
It was a couple of grid slots, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it was going through a bit of the doldrums at the time, wasn't it? World Superbike.
Yes. It wasn't its most exciting.
So I think, it's a shame we couldn't have just run that other year, because Carl had gone back to the Ducati family, and I'm sure something would have happened. But anyhow, it didn't. So, it was on, what should we do next job again then? So jumping down the line, I had eventually... did nearly 6 years with, 5 years with Crescent, building the BSB team up, which we had a lot of success. And then in 2011, which was, everybody knows, that was one of the closest BSB championships with Tommy and John, we had a Samsung sponsorship, which I was pretty pleased that I'd negotiated with Samsung and the people who were dealing with it. And I was really, we got that because we were struggling with sponsorship, and that came up. I worked really hard on that. And as I said to Paul at the time, because he said, all right, well, I'll come down. I said, no, just leave it. Just leave it with me. And we sorted it. And we had a good deal, cracking sponsorship deal. There were no trouble at all. I always remember at times, we'll do it for such a price. We'll put the hospitality. I said, no. This is just a technical budget. Then if they want hospitality, that's extra.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we might lose it. Just leave it. Because I knew we were there. You know, it was only a matter of just ticking a few things off. So we had a really good deal, and we had a cracking year there with Samsung, and they were no problem. They enjoyed it, and great championship.
Incredible.
But then, towards the end of the year, we could go World Superbike, get Samsung involved. It sounds good, but no, this is Samsung Mobile UK. It's nothing to do with World, nothing to do with International. That's out in, is it Korea or wherever they are, isn't it? That's theirs. We'll get it. Well, in the end, I mean, they got so pissed off with this. They just, and if so, I mean, I'm not having to go at Paul, because it was Paul's business. He wanted to go World Superbike. And so we lost the Samsung thing then. And they went to Honda.
Went to Honda, didn't they?
Because that was building up. We could have had more the following year and the year after. Because it was a great promotion for them, you know.
Well, they ended up winning the championship with Alex Lowe's, didn't they?
Yeah. But they didn't get... With Honda, they found it harder, with Honda.
It's different with the factory team in that, especially Honda, they have their way.
Because we were a lot more flexible.
Yeah.
You know, we could go down the factory and et cetera, et cetera. So we're going World Superbike. Right, okay. So then it was Yoshimura then going to supply all the engines, which... Great company, Yoshimura, lovely family, people, really, really, really nice. But I'm cutting a bit of a long story short now. Our engine was actually a better engine than what they had from the British. Yeah, we had a better performing engine. There's nothing wrong with theirs, but it wasn't quite as good as what we developed ourselves. And again, then what happens then, the deal is, they send the engines, and they will send the technician and everything, but we can't touch them, just the engines and et cetera. So the Japanese way of working is, this is what's happening in MotoGP to a certain extent, is I think the British and the European, if something's working, we'll try it. And you have the confidence to go and race it. Well, what they do, oh, we need to do maybe 2 months testing, then we check where, then we check this. And it's a slower way of operating, you know. And sometimes you get behind.
Sometimes you just got to go, okay, yeah, let's do it.
You've got to believe in what you're doing.
100%.
You know, you've got to believe in what you're doing. So, let's put it this way. We were not ready to go World Superbike racing. You know, the old setup wasn't ready. And there was a lot of bits of things behind the scenes where the Moto Grand Prix team had sort of finished.
Yeah.
So in one of the warehouses at Crescent, that was full of all that gear because it had all been moved. And we were all involved in shifting stuff and we're going World Superbike. And that was so frustrating. So frustrating. I'm like, what am I doing here?
You kind of feel diluted a little bit to what you were doing.
Oh, massive. Yeah. I'm like, 2 o'clock in the morning. I wonder how many team managers will be pushing flight cases across from a Grand Prix team into a warehouse when we're supposed to be going World Superbike racing. You know, there was a lot of that at the beginning and everything was trying to be cutting corners on all sorts of stuff, you know. I mean, I didn't even think the bikes looked okay in a picture. But we had the bikes done in vinyl. So they were just like saving on paintwork. We got somebody to do it. I mean, they wish they'd never took the job on, I think, in the end, because pressure, if you're crashing, you want more bodywork.
More you need.
Keep up with it. Driving up and down the motorway, picking that up.
And applying just, it. I've watched Tommy Hill apply the vinyls to it. Yeah. It's like, good grief. There's an art to that.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
So there's all bits of stuff like that. And then obviously Hopper had that finger issue all the way through the season, the season before. So he went back to America and he had some more work done on that. And then we ended up going to Phillip Island then for the start, 2 day test before, etc. And then he smashes his finger up. So he's out straight away. So then we've got Brooksy in to cover. But the bikes are dog slow. I mean, dog slow. And everybody's on a right downer, you know. Even the Yoshimura a lot were. We need more speed, you know. I was just annihilated. Just totally annihilated.
It's going to show up there as anywhere, isn't it? Because it's all corner speed and then that front straight.
Fast long left onto the straight.
Yeah.
Boom. So, you know, that was real, really tough year. Really tough year. You know, and it just went like that more or less throughout the year. Hopper came back eventually, and then he had another big off at Monza. Monza had a big off there, because his hips weren't good anyway.
No.
And smashed all that up.
There wasn't much of him that was good, bless him, by that point.
No, he was well battered. So Leon did a terrific season, and Frankie was guiding Leon, and he had a really good season to say. You know, I don't think we were properly prepared for it personally. And I remember one at Yoshimura, one of the engines let go, and the guy was in tears. I took him to one side and I said, "Look," I said, you are Japanese, you are warrior sort of thing to him. You know, I said, "No crying, you go back, make better," you know. I said, It's happened, you know.
It's racing.
Just go back. You know, we don't do that. Just keep fighting, you know.
You don't want anybody falling on the sword just because the engine's gone.
Exactly.
Don't do that.
They're great people. They really were. But they struggled, you know. And then it was just real. It was the hardest. I say that's one of the hardest seasons I've done that, and the least enjoyable. From a working perspective.
Yeah, which is a massive shame, isn't it?
Couldn't get anything out of it.
Yeah.
you know.
Because you want, from your point of view, even the success might have been a top 10 or a top 5. You knew the package wasn't, it wasn't a winning package.
No.
But, and I'm a big, the ladies and gents that listen to the show and that watch the show, I'm a big believer in small wins.
Yeah.
And if your bike on its given day with a strong prevailing wind is the 8th placed bike out there and you get 8th, that's a win. That's where you need to be. And that's, you celebrate that as a success. And if you get 7th or 6th, even better.
That's it. I mean, the only enjoyable thing of that year was the travelling winter tracks I'd never been to, like at Moscow Raceway and places like that.
There as well, yeah.
Yeah. You know, that was an experience and, But that all that side was good, you know, and fortunately I've always been able to, if there's like a gap between racing and testing, I can wind down. You know, I'm not one of them who all frustrated. I'm still thinking about it, but I can still wind down with it. So that obviously helped, you know.
That's important. But does that kind of come from the, sort of the TT side of things where you have to be able to wind down and you can sort of condition yourself to that? Because if you don't, it will consume you and you'll end up burning yourself out, especially in this game.
I did take it as 24/7. I mean, I've been sat when I've been away skiing, say, in winter, I've been sat outside a bar at the top of a mountain and taking phone calls regarding racing. My phone was always on and I was always available. But even in the downtime, I could sort of handle it, if you get what I mean. It didn't bother me because I loved the job so much. But I could still wind down and still had a finger on the pulse with the job, if you get what I mean.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I guess a lot of that is a longevity to it because you learn to enjoy the bits that you can and not stress over the ones. Yeah. It's controlling the uncontrollable, controlling the controllables. The rest of it's out of your concern.
Yeah, I mean, the thing, going back to the Foggy Patronus job, I knew we couldn't win a race, but as long as we keep improving the bike, and the lap time comes down from a previous race at a certain circuit, that's satisfying because you know you're doing your job right, the boys are doing the job right, the rider's doing his job right. But when you can't do anything and you it's not going right, full stop, and you can't make any improvements or you can see you could make improvements, but something's holding it back, whether it's budget or some other restriction. That's frustrating then.
You see, one of the other ones that I'm favourite of is distance, the time to the race winner.
That's something that
maybe some of the listeners and viewers haven't maybe considered, but as another win, if you're getting within 10, 5, whatever seconds of the race winner,
absolutely,
that's marked progress.
Yeah. Yeah, because you can say, we've had a fourth place, wow, fantastic, or been on the podium. But you've got on that podium because there's somebody been crashes, yet you could still be, whatever, 20 seconds behind the winner. But then in another meeting, you could be 8th and only, say, 4 seconds behind the winner.
That's a better marker than anything.
Much better. Yeah. It's not on paper, it doesn't, but I mean, from the team's point of view and the direction you're going, it's a lot better, better way to do it.
It's the way for motivation, isn't it? We are making progress. This is where the progress is.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps you pushing forward all the time.
Absolutely.
So was that when the Suzuki time finished?
Yeah.
Was that the last foray into World Superbikes?
That was my last foray because obviously I knew at some point Paul would come back to run the team.
Yes.
It was never talked, but it was obvious that was going to happen because he'd finished with the Moto Grand Prix.
Of course.
He took like a year sabbatical sort of thing and doing other things or whatever. Obviously, when they carried on in World Superbike the following year, we had a sponsor who'd been involved with us in BSB, a company called Fixie. Like an investment type sort of company, and they come on board. I mean, they one of the directors there, he was dead keen, and he was a friend of the team, so that they came on board there, you know. So yeah, and they were on board too. Well, they were actually on board the year I was there as well, Fixie. Yeah.
It went on to strength, but it took its time, didn't it, to get?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they got a bit more budget, and they had Eugene Laverty then, yes. And he got some podiums, but they're still struggling.
It was a tough series to be a part of, wasn't it?
Yeah,
especially against the factory teams.
Yeah,
as well before they became a factory team.
That's right.
It's a difficult place to be.
Because there was no real. They didn't really have everything. Was through like Yoshimura and what you did yourself. So. Yeah, they had a better year the following year, which they quite rightly should have done, you know. But yeah, well, I enjoyed it, you know.
That's the important thing.
Yeah.
It's something that you look back on fondly. I can see
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
But that was the one thing that we didn't get to talk about this time last year was the World Superbike things. It was just fascinating of how that evolved and the riders that you evolved with, especially the Foggy Patronus project.
Yeah.
You will never see the likes of that again.
No.
Ever. Nobody will put that
something
investment
there from
in.
The Foggy Patronus. Piston and Rod.
Piston and Rod from there.
Yeah.
We keep that on the side. I just wonder if it's intact.
This is, yeah. Yeah, it is. The bearing looks a bit knackered. What's in it?
Yeah, don't look inside it. That's the thing. One of the other reasons for coming out to see you, as well as it's been a year, and it's always lovely to come out and see you, so thank you, Jack. Much appreciated. Is the TT side of things.
Yep.
The road racing generally just fascinates me. And having the chat with Ian Simpson earlier this year, who was a great rider for you and Steve for V&M and super successful. Just talk me through the TT years, because I think there's so much success and so much passion that you had for it and still do have for it.
I do, yeah. I mean, I think TT comes from years ago when I first... riding on street bikes, because you know you're getting involved on motorbikes. It's like TT. I mean, we're only 40 miles down to the ferry.
Yeah.
So that was it. Every year off to the TT, being riding around there like lunatics with your mates, you know. And so obviously, I think even myself, if I'd have carried on when I was doing a little bit of club racing, if I'd have carried on that side, I 100% gone to the TT, because I used to just love. Riding fast on.
Well, you cut your teeth on the roads, didn't you? That's it, yeah.
I just loved it. I mean, obviously, not as much traffic back then, but yeah, and I mean, obviously, you know, when we started to get involved then with the business, we were fortunate in one respect. We had Dave Leach, who lived over the other side of the hill from us, and Leachy came over. He had an FZR 600 at the time, and they were the new 600 on the block back in, what was it, maybe would that be 89-ish, I think. Great 89.
89, maybe. It would have come to you.
And we'd done some work on Mark Forsyth's FZR 600 for, I think it was PB, performance bike mag at the time. And I think Leach had seen that or something. But anyway, he came over, could we do anything with his bike? It was only like about 3 weeks before the TT, so we couldn't really do anything other than setting up for him. And he had a decent result on it with a, more or less standard engine. So it sort of went from there then. And we got involved with him doing his bikes and little 400 Yam come out. We won that with TT with him on that with a lap record. And and it sort of grew from there. And, you know, when we started our own professional team, when V&M actually had its own team, was 94-ish, if I remember rightly. It's 94, yeah.
Ian Duffus?
No,
or was it 93
no,
with Moody?
It'd be... No, we'd done... With the little 400s, with the 400 Yam, we'd done just out of the back of the van job.
Okay.
We used to go with our own 400s, coming back to me now, in 90, 91, 92 era, because Foggy rode our 400 Yam there.
Of course.
Leachy was on our 400 again. And Jim was also on it, and he still holds the actual lap record on one of our engines, Jim. But yeah, and then 94 come when we started V&M itself, and we went from there. Then it was just TT every year. 94 was, we're going to have Mark Farmer on the bike at the TT. We'd done the Northwest with him, lovely guy. And then unfortunately, he lost his life on the Britain. And I can remember that quite clearly with that, because again, you know, I don't want to talk bad about anything, but every time the Britain came in, there was oil all over it. Oil all over the bike. And Mark used to say, just, I'm out on the Britain now, so just have the Yamaha there just in case there's a problem again. And yeah, he didn't want to say, unfortunately lost his life on it. I think it was Thursday afternoon practice, I think, if I remember rightly. Black dub there. So yeah, another Irish rider, Stucky and King, on it then, just for the race, just to be, you know, we were there, so yeah, stuck somebody on it. And then we went from there, basically. Then 95, Honda chased us down so hard, we ended up going with Honda. I didn't want to go with Honda. I wanted to stay with Yamaha, but they were dilly-dallying around, and I think I touched on it in the last interview we did. They were dilly-dallying around with what they could give us, what, you know, I wanted a super bike just to play around with and just enter when we fancied it. So they were, but Honda was chasing us down, so we went with Honda.
Sorry to interrupt. We're doing our best to grow this show of ours, and you can really help with that. All we ask is that you like and follow on whichever platform you're listening on, and if you really enjoy what we do, then leave us a review. It's genuinely the most helpful thing you can do after listening to us. And also, while I'm here, a huge thank you to Chris at Riding Graphics for updating all of the Off-Track podcast graphics. There's a link to his social media feeds in the description, so please take a look at his work. And if you drop any work his way, please let him know that you came via the podcast. Thank you so much, and back to the show.
And yeah, that's when Duffy's won the TT, and I had Joy on the bike as well. Joy was fourth. 600 on the.
I don't have the opportunity too often, because he was his own man in a lot of ways, and obviously he rode for the factory Honda as well.
Yeah.
But what was it like to work with? This is the first time I've ever asked this question. What was it Fantastic. Like to work yeah, with Joey?
Not a problem. It came about because I had Duffy's was obviously riding short circuits for us, along with Mike Edwards at the time.
Yeah.
And well, the new Duffy's would be okay at the TT. So I didn't get another teammate in. And Joey had always been with John Harris Motorcycles on the 600 on there. And, you know, I went about it diplomatically. I had a word with David Woods, who was his manager at the time. And I said, do you think Joey would be interested in riding one of our bikes? I said, but I don't want to cause any problem with John, because he's always rode John's bikes. He said, well, leave it with me. So he could, but he said, Joey, he'd love to. John's all right about it. So that's when we had the Duckhams on, was the, you know, the blue and yellow ones. So yeah, I said, well, all he said, I said, he'll need to just get a set of leathers, obviously, to match up. So I sent him all the designs and what have you. But I thought, we got to the Northwest, and I thought, I'm not gonna push him, because I've not worked with Joey. Obviously, you just go like, you know, they don't nod when you see each other, but never worked with him. Even though I had a few drinks in his pub. We get to the Northwest, and he was on the, he said, I'm going to take the little one out first on the Laurie McKennemy little 125. And he's got his all green and white, dirty white cushy tarnies on.
I can picture those.
So he goes off on that. So he said, I have the other bike ready. So I said, yeah, so the other bike ready. So I expect him just to jump on it. Took the leathers off, put brand new V&M leathers on. And I'm like, wow. You know, I weren't going to bother. I mean, as long as they had them on in the race and stuff.
Yeah.
Changed during that pit lane. And he's off like, you know. So, yeah, that's how it started. And there were no problems. Went to the TT with him. And we used to be out on it all, you know, every practice session he went out on it. And no issues with him. And his men would have tea ready for him in the morning. And they'd all have a chat after. And He said, I think I just need a slightly softer rear spring. So I said, well, we normally keep it basically like the short circuit, the yeah. Super sport bike, just change the damping a little bit, just to absorb the bumps. But I said, well, if that's what you want, so we wouldn't normally, but if that's what you want. Anyway, kind of long story short, when he before then, actually, he went out behind Duffy's, and he stayed behind Duffy's for a lap. He'd done a lap behind Duffy's before he made this decision, and he said he really enjoyed it. He said, because Duffy's was like short-circuiting little bits, but then on the real fast bits, Joey would like pull him in again. So he said it was quite good to see that. I were like a short-circuit rider, regular short-circuit rider was riding it. Anyway, in the race, he went with that spring, and he ended up fourth. We were third, and then we just got put down to fourth. I think Colin Gable at the time, late Colin Gable, he just pipped us to fourth. And he said after, I didn't have mind that, he said, you were right. He said, I should have stayed with that harder spring. He said, we're just like bottoming out in certain sections. So, yeah, I mean, it's great. When you get that sort of response from a rider, it wasn't like just, all right, thank you, gone,
The response and the respect is what it's all about.
And then what was really nice was, what would it be? A good few years later, I was in his pub at the Northwest, and he has a display cabinet in the back, and on the mannequin, it was the V&M leathers. It was dressed in the V&M leathers, the Duckham's leathers.
See, that's a beautiful one, isn't it? That's,
that's brilliant,
For the amount of people that see it, and for the short time that he was with you.
Yeah.
What a great nod from a great
man.
And then
at the Ulster, see, they were on road racing. He was riding so many different bikes at the Ulster. Yeah. And it was a hot day for once. And he was absolutely knackered. And he said, I don't know whether I can ride the 600. He said, I've got a super bike. He said, would you mind if I didn't? I'll see how I get on. I said, right, it's entirely up to you. There's no worries. I said, you know yourself. I know he wanted to ride it if he can, but he must have been shattered. He looked shattered. And he still rode it. It was all right. I forget what result we got, but it was a decent result,
So what a wonderful legacy as well.
That's great.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
But also with the successes that you had over there with Simo and with Moody and Duffers and Spike Edwards at Macau. It was all there. It was all down to you and Steve and the team and the riders that you had. It was a real golden period.
Yeah, I think what we had was we had a close-knit team. And, I was sort of directing it. Steve was working harder and harder on different engine, upgrades or whatever. But it was a team about around us as well. We all wanted the same thing. And that's what made it. I mean, I even had guys in the team who've never been involved with racing, but they followed our sort of direction and passion, and that makes hell of a difference,
It does.
They're prepared to put ridiculous hours in if they need to,
It's whatever it takes to get the job done.
So that, that's what it's really all about. And it was only funny enough the other day, there was something on the social media, on X as it's called now, and it showed Rob Max Cadbury's boost team. And I replied to Rob and said, what a team. And they were the same. Then a couple of years there, all them boys in Rob's team were the same, There were no prima donnas or anything.
AD Marsh, Jimmy Smith.
All those guys, yeah.
All the guys,
yeah.
And they're all still around now.
Yeah, well, Barry Stanley was
Baz Stanley,
crew chief for me at Petronas with Steve Martin.
Of course, he worked there as well, hadn't he?
Yeah, super guy.
And he was
still in the paddock with.
Jason. Yeah. At McCann's the last few years. I don't know where he's. I'm sure
he never changes, Barry.
No, he does.
Never changes, Barry Stanley. He could still probably get in his leathers from when he was racing 125s.
Little racing snake, isn't he? What a great fella.
Great guy. Great fabricator. Put so much hours in when we were at Petronas,
One thing that I think a lot of the fans and the listeners and the viewers don't realise is just how much talent and knowledge and experience still sits in that British Superbike paddock.
That's right, yeah.
And it's kind of the same faces that have been there the last 20, 25 years because they are the best at what they do.
Yeah.
Your Spanners, your Barry Stanleys, your Matt Llewellyn moving in from Ryder to... Yeah. There's so many across the board. Stewie at Worlds, PJ, you can list them all.
I think you get a lot, even if you look at Moto Grand Prix, there's a lot of sort of older generation crew chiefs still there. I think there's a lot more maybe younger talent coming through maybe on electronics and stuff.
Yeah.
Because they're all like, I don't know if it's the future, but it's the way it's all going, isn't it? So, you know, they're going to universities and they're learning all that sort of stuff. And, well, maybe a lot of the old, really old school crew chiefs, they're not at that sort of level. So then you have that guy in there and the guy who's been around a few years, he could direct it how he wants it to go.
Sure.
And he tells the electronics guy what he needs and they work together, you know.
Because some of the fundamentals haven't changed and never will change because it's still a racing motorcycle. Yeah. But you're just bringing those extra things that, like, they're so much more reliant on electronics these days. But you still have to change your spring rates. You still need what springs you have. You still need your damping and your compression.
Et cetera,
You still need all
that. Angles, offsets, all that.
Rake and all that. Yeah. Everything's still multiple things that you can
change.
But
sometimes, you know, you get yourself in a knot. You know, I just said, come on, boys, look, let's just get back to basics. Let's get back to basics, maybe even put a base setting in and then start again because you can get lost, you know, there's no question.
Frankie was saying that when I spoke to Frankie Carcedi a couple of weeks ago. He said sometimes you've just got to walk away. It's almost like if a 1,000-piece jigsaw on the coffee table, you can't find that piece, but you go off and you have a coffee and you come back and you go, well, it was there all the time.
That's it,
It's all there.
Yeah.
It's just finding it.
Yeah. But, no, it's right. You just need that break. And like I say, I've said earlier, where even though you're shutting off, you're not shutting off. You're just like just relaxing something and something's ticking over. Then you're like,
It's just seeing the woods for the trees, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a fascinating one. And this is what I love about doing the podcast is finding that out about the people. The racing's great, but it's the people that make it. Tell me about 97 with Simon Moody on the... You had the RC45s that year.
No, that was 97 would be Rutter.
Oh, was it?
Rutter and...
was it 98. 97, Simo got the lap record on the Supersport, didn't he? And then 98, you got the RC45s.
Yeah, 97 I was with Simo and Rutter on the big bike. Simo was riding British Championship.
Yes.
And TT for us. And Michael was riding British Championship on Superbike and the Rhodes.
It was a year out.
Yeah.
I was a year out on that one because it was the fascinating conversation because...
I think that was Simo's first win at the TT on our Supersport bike.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
And then he won because you both moved to Honda for that. Were you two
we were with
Honda?
Honda then. We're still with Honda.
Still Honda at the time.
Yeah.
But then as a more of a factory effort, he was saying that you'd had customer RC45s for the British Championship, which weren't a patch on the factory bikes, but the Honda, because it was there was an anniversary.
What we had was factory engines that year for Michael.
Right.
In our RC45.
Yes.
Because that's when he was third in the World Superbike.
Of course.
In the wild card, which I think he still remembers quite well that. And then the following year was the 50th year anniversary for Honda.
That was it.
And we'd done a hell of a lot of work. I got all the HRC drawings of the chassis, made all jigs, all the frames were absolutely bang on. Massive amount of work. And then in 98 then, unfortunately, it was a little bit to do with Michael because... He got a bit sucked in with this factory. And the only factory is when HRC bring a full factory RVF. Okay, we had a factory engine,
but
when you're talking full factories, when they bring
the RVF
with the Japanese technician, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so what we've done, we've got the bikes as close to, well, in fact, what was he called? Nakamoto San?
Yes.
He used to be the F1 guy as well. He went to F1. He was a super bike.
Shuhei Nakamoto.
Yeah, Nakamoto. He saw our bikes at Donington, and he said, "Oh, factory, very beautiful." He was over the moon with them. But we had factory suspension on the Shure suspension, yeah. And basically re-engineered, copied everything possible, and manufactured, had everything made. So the bikes were beautiful. Biggest problem was we had Michelin tyres, and I wanted to run Dunlops. Michael wanted to run Dunlops, but I only wanted to run Michelin's TT. They always run well. TT, there won't be any problem.
No,
short circuits held us back, and obviously he started having few issues at short circuits because it was just it was down to tyres, and then it started. I think there's a bit going on behind the scenes because we took on ex-World Superbike mechanic who, to be honest, I would have ready for sacking him anyway because he just never turned up. He just turned up when he wanted to turn up. And but it got a bit brainwashed. Anyway, cut a bit of a long story short, they decided that they wanted to put Roger Harvey in to run the team. We had all the workshop, we'd done all the workshops, everything. And, well, right, around me and Steve, what? So what's that? Well, yeah, just to keep things, you know, all well, no problem apart from what I've just said to you. Now, well, that's right. So we went away, we're gobsmacked. So we just told him to stick it. Just like that, just stick it. You could carry on with our workshops, we won't kick you out, just pay the rent on it and everything. That's what we did. So obviously they went off and won all the TTs because they had all the best riders because we made sure of that from the year before, which I was dead chuffed with. And then Michael came back to the British scene, and he got on Dunlops then. Finally put him on Dunlops, so TT's gone. He's there, he's on the podium, regular, everything. Bike, great. Well, at Donington, you could run them with an oil cooler or without the oil cooler. When you took the oil cooler off, you had to blank something. I forget how it went. They blank something off anyway, so it still had the circulation. And this young lad, local lad actually, who'd come on board, no experience with me, racing, but he'd learned everything through us. This mechanic had taken it off, and the lad had said, "That's not right. You need to do this, do that. Tell me what to do, 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 do." Rutter goes out, bike sees solid going into red gate. Factory engine. They don't do that. So, end of story then. They got flicked him.
Rightly so. Know.
But this could have been sorted out.
Yeah.
From the beginning. Okay, probably in hindsight, because we felt insulted after what we'd done, and all the success we'd had with Honda from 95 when they begged us to go with them, we felt a bit insulted and we thought we don't need that. But it could have probably been sorted a bit different. But anyway, yeah, so that was it then, you know. So then the end of that year, we had, unfortunately, the dyno fire in the workshops. So that leads us on then to 99. You know, I was at the Intermot show in Germany when they had the fire and a customer engine. I think I touched on it on the last pod you did with me, but a customer engine was running bad. They got it running right and the clutch was slipping. Oh. So they put a clutch in it and then everything was, you know, it's working as it should do. But then dropped everything in the bottom end and set the whole place on fire. Fortunately, it was very fortunate, we had the workshop what Honda was in. Well, they were coming out anyway at the end of that year. So right. I did have somewhere to go, but it was still a major operation, you
100%.
Know. So they that brings us on to 99 when, what did we do? You know, with no budget or anything, but the TT was always there. We could always sort of figure out something for the TT, which is, you know, that's what we did with the R1, you know, and the rest is history, as they say.
Just looking at the pictures off on the side there.
Yeah. We sort of put things right, you know, we showed on the, what we could really do again.
How much satisfaction did you get out of that?
Massive, massive. Still get satisfaction to this day.
Good.
Because, I mean, you know, they tried everything then on the, I mean, they did bring like factory stuff over at the time for Joy and that. We just did what we did best. We built a fast engine and a bike what was stable. Even still had standard front forks in off the R1. Didn't even have a set of superbike forks in.
If it worked, it worked.
Yeah, yeah.
It's built for the road.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's it. And, I say it's superb. You know what I mean? And the good people at Honda were, you know, really happy for us as well. You know.
See, that's important as well, isn't it? Especially there.
Yeah.
There has to be respect across.
You know.
I couldn't agree more.
But sometimes, you know, it's like I say, going back to that, maybe we could have done something a little bit different. But I think at the time, Honda, they were going through, certainly the year after, and certainly from then on, things changed at Honda because there was a lot of people like who just make decisions. They just say, you can have this bike, that bike, we'll sort that out. But there were no like contracts or anything. It was all done like on a matey sort of basis. But then stuff like that can sometimes go a bit wrong. If somebody a bit higher up, hey, what are you spending that? Oh, we can't do that now. We're going to do this and... You know,
if you've got nothing signed, you've got no comeback, have you?
No, that's it.
And then you have to deal with the fallout from it. And then, what's plan B?
So it's all experience, isn't it? You know,
it is. I mean, one of the stories that I asked Simo when we were there, he regaled a story of yourself and Steve on the Harley. You'd been out the night before, and I can't remember which pub it was. You basically turn up in the paddock where you could ride straight in. You've got the little tin pot helmets on, cigar, make way, V&M coming through, make way. It just fired you straight into the back of the truck. Go and sleep it off.
He's exaggerating.
I thought he might be, but I thought I'd just have that. Yeah. And what are your best memories of working with Jim and Simo? Because what a pair of characters.
Well, when we're working with the Scottish lads.
Duffus as well, the old Scottish Armada. I mean,
we did a lot of work with them because, again, it was from our engine building with like Leachy, and we did a bit with Mick Grant when he had this... Again, we always used to get these things where other people couldn't sort of get going, right? Like bloody teacups, he used to call them, 600 teacup, horrible thing. We're doing those bikes for them. And, you got one engine done. So I forget who we did first, maybe Moody's. I think we might have done Moody's. So Moody got off then straight away winning. So then Simo comes, then he wants one. And then they all start coming, Duffy's, Howard, Selby.
Selby's
loads
another
of
one,
them,
yeah.
Loads of them. And they're great, you know, there were no problem with them at all. There are a few dodgy-looking crankcases used to arrive, you know, but I'll say no more about that. Because there's a lot of that going on in them days, you know, especially with racing.
Racing's racing.
Because they clamped down a lot on all that, haven't they now? And it's just built from there, you know. The thing what we did with me and Steve with V&M, we didn't really come in from a low level. We came straight in at British Championship level.
Yeah.
You know.
Countless championships and race wins.
Yeah.
It was all there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The business was first. The team came after. You'd already made your reputation before the team started.
Yeah, that's it. But it was always racing with us. You know, it's a business because you've got to run. You've got to pay your bills. You've got to tick over and what have you. But it was never really about trying to make a fortune. It was we wanted our customers winning. If we didn't win, our customers were winning, you know. And he used to bag me off a bit sometimes when you, because we always did. The only thing different between our bikes and a customer bike was that we might strip ours down, say, on a more regular basis, because you're looking for little things and touching and tickling. And yeah, maybe, you know, if you're gaining horsepower, like chuff to hell. But that was the only difference. You know, you probably more tinkering.
Yeah.
But they had the same engine. Everything was the same spec. But, you know, because it's your own, you're tinkering with it more, you know. And we did them all identical. You get the odd one who obviously couldn't ride the thing. And then they become plain, oh, it's not the same. I've changed this, I've changed that. And not realising usually it's his mate next door who hasn't had an engine done by him. He's just trying to find out what's in the engine of his mates, you know. So when they bring them back, and they'd all been messed around with.
I was going to say, that was one of the questions. Do you ever open an engine and go, what have you done?
Yeah, they come back like, some of them 10 horsepower down from what we sent out. All because somebody's been tinkering with cam timing or altering jetting or whatever, you know. Crazy.
Just leave it alone.
Yeah.
We've done it.
Yeah.
This is what we do.
Yeah. But no, it's great, because when we're dealing with the top runners, they know straight away, you know. And it's did quite a bit of stuff with one or two of the Irish lads as well. But yeah, it was good days.
Tell me about Macau, because I've never been, and that kind of fascinates me. So to go out there, you got the victory with DJ
yeah,
and with Spike Edwards before that.
Yeah, and I've won like the 600 race, Callum Ramsey. Been on podium with Bruce Anstey. Yeah.
What are your favourite memories of being out at Macau?
Going to Thailand after.
Is that the way? Getting out of there.
No. I mean, no, Macau's great.
Yeah.
I'd go back again tomorrow. It's fabulous. I mean, it's one of those, it's a bit like in the Middle East, it changes every year. It's just, if you go one year, wow, you go back the next year, it's different again, and it's just building and building is the place, you know. But it was really, because obviously Mike Trimmer used to run that originally when we were going, and he put on he used to look after us all and everything, you know, it was proper. And he wanted it, yeah, it's a race, but he'd be, look, not anybody's sticking their neck out, but you're all coming home, you're all got your 8 days in Thailand after to chill out, just, you know, take it easy. And, in fact, if there was anybody who was riding reckless, they wouldn't get on the trip again. You know, he was pretty good, pretty sharp like that. And
Willie.
Yeah, I mean, the whole atmosphere of the place, Amco barrier all the way around, really dangerous place. Yeah. You know, you don't want to be crashing.
No.
You take a very limited amount of equipment out there. You know, you just got to be careful what you pack. You know, you're changing your own tyres and all that sort of thing. So it's just totally different. It was just a great way to end the season. In fact, we used to start the season with Daytona back then.
Yeah.
On the MCN tour. That was a Trimby one as well, because I did that for about 3 years with Dave Leach. That was a similar sort of thing. And we used to end up at Macau. But yeah, it was just a good crack, you know, good laugh with all the lads, and they always looked after us really well out there. We had to do a few stuff for the local council, doing bits of silly games and stuff, you know, just to promote the event.
Sure.
With the car drivers. And of course, bike riders against car drivers. They can't wait, the bike riders. You know, they're going to have it. I remember when you were with the karting, there's a car, bike riders against the car lads. So they're all psyched up for it. They've all been out practicing. They're going to kill them. But we don't want to race. We're going to go off lap times.
Oh.
That's not... spoiled it.
They were going to be straight into the tyre wall there. They're not messing about like that.
Yeah. But yeah, great times, you know. It's more of a, you know, it is a serious race, and it's nice to win it, of course. But it was more just of an end of season thing.
Yeah.
There's no pressure. you know, like the Cowboys, I think saying a world touring cars and yeah. F3. I mean, all the top F1 drivers have won at Macau at some point.
It's a big draw for them, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big end of the season for them. But for us, we're sort of a sideshow, really. We're out early in the morning, you know, on the dirty street circuit and stuff. But it's just good, big camaraderie. You know, it's like, you know, it was like sharing garages with others. Well, when you're racing in like the BSB, you tend to, you're in your own little like world, aren't you? You know, you're not sharing tools and stuff. And,
no.
But over there, you were sharing everything. So it was great. It was like club racing,
isn't it? It is club racing back in the old days, isn't it?
Yeah, it was great. I always remember one year talking to Pete Jennings earlier on. He we'll get there. I was with the 600s and he was there because anything went over there. Apart from the super sport class, which was FIM. And he's there with a 600 on, there was a turbocharger on. Steve Burns, who was doing a lot with turbos at the time, you know, the ex. Yeah, we worked with Steve quite a bit on some of his projects. And he's there, like, he's like laughing his head off. So I said, you're not going to do anything in the big race with that 600 turbo. Oh, we're in super sport. This is FIM regulations. Oh, anything goes here. And he got moved. He got moved out.
600 turbo.
Yeah. I don't think he even finished the race on it.
It wouldn't surprise me.
No.
You can't imagine it being particularly reliable.
No. Well, it's things like that, you know, he had a real good laugh.
I think Daytona was a big one for you as well, wasn't it?
Daytona was good. I mean, we were pretty competitive there with Leachy and that. And it was just, the problem with Daytona was you didn't know where you were with tyres because it always seemed like, I remember one year, I think it was the last year we went there, we qualified really well. So we were on for like a certain top six, maybe even better because you've got to be dead consistent. And we've got some good lap times. And then we got the tyre off the Dunlop technician. This is what you want now. And it was rock hard. As soon as he set off, within two laps, where is he? What's happening? Couldn't even put a lap time in. So we had to come in. But we had the other one on the other rim was the same.
Really?
Yeah. So we had to come in. We had to send him out again, rush back with that then to get another tyre on and then bring him in. Well, you're knackered.
It's all done then, isn't it?
No. You're knackered. And I mean, it's happened many times. I think it was Scott Russell one year where, was it against Foggy? It might have been against Foggy, one of them, but he shouldn't have won. He'd been passing on yellows or something. He shouldn't have won. And there was a little bit of favouritism to the Americans.
That's not a surprise.
No. And then there was a good year when Philip McCallum, he was having a good ride, and he was in third place. And right at the end of the start and finish straight, just before it tipped into the infield, front tyre burst. Yeah, boom, just blew apart. Yeah.
Bloody hell.
So that's when the superbikes were on the bankings, I get a lot of tyre issues and delamination and stuff.
Well, the pressures and the centrifugal forces push, they're not used to that.
But that the Daytona always reminded me a little bit of the TT because majority of the field were like, or the back end of the field were more club races.
Yeah,
you know they weren't even anywhere near in the same league as our lads.
Just going for the experience.
Yeah. So what you actually had, you had like, you know, the what's he called? Eddie Lawson. Doug
Chandler?
No. Doug Poland.
Doug Poland.
Tom Kipps and stuff like that. They were on like factory Yamahas run by Vance and Hines. And then you got to Scott Russell and that on the Muzzies.
Yeah.
So they were your top enders.
Proper factory bikes.
Yeah.
Factory riders.
And we were coming over basically on what would run in British series, you know. But you could run with them. They had a little bit more tackle for pit stops and stuff like that than what we had. Because we, funny enough, going back to Joy, we'd borrowed a quick fill from when he was in Rothman's days. It's like a big dump tank.
Yeah.
So you've got your aircraft type filler cap. drop it on. Well, Leachy got this off Joey. So when we come to use it, it's got a bloody leak on it. So I had to have a bucket with it in. And it's dripping out all the time. So it's like, obviously the seals must have dried out or something. So it's like, buckets are full of fuel and you're in pit lane and, you know.
Imagine all, trying that these days. Yeah. All chits and giggles until someone giggles and chits. Especially on that front. When you look back over all the achievements that you've done, both with teams and with your own team and with Steve, which one stands out the most?
There is so many. I mean, the 99 TT one always pops up because of the issues we'd had with Honda the previous year. And then just to come back on a no-budget team off our own back and sort of make history. But there's just so many. There really is. I mean, you know, just all the super sport wins we had. I mean, another one where we, in a way, we kicked Honda's backside again was when Moody fell out with them. And I had the R60. We didn't have any budget, but he popped on them and won the championship. Again, out of the back of a van. Those little things stand out because they were sort of like milestones, like where we'd had a few issues, like I said, you know, at the time with Honda. And then to sort of come back at them, you know, just like club racing, really, out of a van, no big trucks, just out of a van. And they were satisfying. But so many. I mean, I've enjoyed all my management, you know. I mean, winning the British Championship with Leon Aslam, you know, it was cruelly taken away from us, or taken away from that challenge of being there when that brake problem, when there's no brakes there. And never got to the root of that. I mean, everything went back to Brembo.
Yeah, nothing ever came from that,
nothing,
did it?
No, nothing. It's, you know, everything was seemed to be okay. So, I don't know. But that was disappointing. But we corrected that the following year.
And then some. Not one DNF.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, what I've found is, everything we've sort of done, I mean, it's like when we were with the Triumphs, we took on a brand new project and we were winning straight away. I mean, TT straight away for a brand new project. When Honda, when we started with the Yamahas, the FZR600s, we had them winning. If we weren't winning, somebody else was Steve Ives or Leachy over in the Rhodes and stuff were winning. And we've always been, you know, I'm not blowing my own trumpet here, but we've always believed we could, whatever project we start, we can win. We can win or we could be right there at the sharp end straight away. And that's what we've done, you know. I mean, so many times. And it's that's things like that are satisfying because you know you're doing your job right. Probably on a note where I wasn't. Well, what really caught me out was with the MV.
Okay.
And I did the old thing with the MV.
Yeah.
Because that engine had so much potential and the quality of the components in the engine were fantastic. But there was it was mainly the air box and the air getting into the engine, which was the issue. Power wise, we couldn't get the power. But normally, that was our secret.
Yeah.
We knew what we were doing. Engine, we could always get power out of an engine. Couldn't get anything out of this thing, so we had to go to the TT with that with Gary on board, Gary Johnson.
Yeah.
Okay, I think he finished eighth, which not so bad, but on a you know well bike with a lot of power down. But it wasn't. Then we started finding a reliability issue, which were valve springs, and it.
Which aren't the most expensive part of the engine, but they're vital.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've got to the bottom of it. You know, I mean, it's fastest MV now ever around the Isle of Man. He's there behind you. Where is he? No, he's gone.
That's Jonesy, isn't it? There?
He's gone somewhere. He used to be there. He might be over there.
Is that over the Balaf.
But, yeah, that's the only one where I would sort of say was a bit I was a bit bagged off with because we I came away from CT because he had valve spring issue initially in the first race. Then he finished eighth, I think, Gary, in the second one. But disappointed, but I thought, oh, well, there's something to build on. But there wasn't, because as we got more power then, these bloody valve springs started going. Yeah.
So the more power and then reliability.
Yeah.
But Hickey did a good job for you on it.
He did, yeah. Yeah, Hickey, I think Hickey was 11th on it with... Well, it's the fastest MV ever around the Isle of Man. I think he just short of 127 lap. He did.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But was it? Was that his first or second year? I can't remember.
I can't remember.
He'd not been going long, had he?
No. But he did a great job on it. But other than that, really, most things what we've been involved with have been good, you know. But even the MV was enjoyable because I'm still trying to solve it. Solve the issue with it, which we did do in the end. But
there's a little bit of shades of Foggy Patronus with that as well. The same sort of challenge.
Yeah, in a little bit of a way. But the frustrating thing with that was, I suppose it was a little bit like a Foggy Patronus because I was trying to find out what it was, and I knew the MV team in World Supersport were having the same problems, and I had a big sit down with them at Donington. And went through everything, and then they'd show me what they'd done. So then I did the same thing to these valve springs, and it was all right. And
so Christian didn't ride in for them at that point. Giacomoto?
No, I don't think so.
He rode the MV, didn't he?
He might have been.
Back in
Worlds,
his short spell in World Superbike with them.
Yeah, well, superb little bike, absolutely.
Yeah,
really were. But no, I say that was just a bit of an experiment. I just wanted to do something there, you know, just mainly TT. And we got it fully sorted, and then Billy Redmayne was going to ride it.
Oh, of course.
That'd have been good because Billy were coming through. He'd been riding real well on his own stuff or the sponsor guy gave him. So that was a shame, but I can't complain. It's a good fun and.
That was going to be with Dave Hopkinson, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Our friend Dave was going to be working with him.
That's right.
He did a lot of work with him, but then that was the next project.
Yeah.
Before Scarborough came along.
That's right. Yeah, we were just ready. Everything was ready to go testing, and then fortunately had the accident at Scarborough.
Do you have a good relationship with Scarborough? Did you have much for it then?
I didn't never wanted to go to Scarborough. I used to go up there on the road bike when I was, you know, a lot younger. But the only time I raced at Scarborough would be with David Jeffries, because the Jeffries family had a big connection there. They'd all won gold cups, etc. They'd all had success up there. And he said, you know, I'm not going to do anything silly. I just, well, of course he won. But I mean, scary stuff like, you know, Jeffries jump, I think they call it.
It is, yeah. That's exactly what it is.
And I know he upset, I think it was Ian Lott. No, it wasn't John McGuinness. He passed John McGuinness on that jump. And John wasn't happy. I mean, they were big mates, but he wasn't happy that time.
That's a fast place to do it.
But that was good. But it's like going back club race. I remember I took the dogs up there, and David had his big fifth wheel caravan thing, and his mum's there with pie and peas. I've got my dogs tied up there and beer on the go, and it's a good crack, though, isn't it? I mean, I'd recommend anybody go to Scarborough because...
No question.
Especially if you like your biking and what have you, and you get over there, you've got the races, you get down on the prom and, you know, your fish and chips and your ice cream and all the typical English stuff.
It's a proper knotted hanky job, isn't it?
Yeah, if the weather's right, it's great, isn't it?
There's nowhere else to be, is it? It's a great place.
Fantastic.
Hopefully we'll get back there. We didn't make it last year, but hopefully we'll go back.
We used to do a bit with Dean Ashton because we did some of Dean Ashton's bikes back in the day. He had a lot of success around Scarborough.
Another local good rider.
Good place. Just hope it keeps going, you know, because you don't want to lose places like that.
No, but it's part of the heritage, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
We were talking to Stavros the other day, and he was saying, you know, he had a bit of success around there. Barry had success around there. Jan O'Saarinen raced it. There's so many. When you look at the board of winners that's on the start finish.
Well, he used to be part of the British Championship.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Yeah.
He can't even imagine that now.
No.
Especially even the 600s look a bit too quick around there.
Well, I always just think, you know, he got something like Barry Sheen going there and he complained about a TT and go a place like Scarborough.
But still went to Scarborough?
Yeah.
But then they rode in Matra and the old Brno and the old, all the road circuits.
That's right.
And the Stort, places like that.
Sachsenring.
Yeah.
Not Sachsenring. Is it Salzburg Ring?
Salzburg Ring was a big one, wasn't it?
Big, dangerous, fast circuit. Spa was.
Spa was.
Well, when you look at some of their old photographs, but everything changes, doesn't it?
It does. I mean,
for the better in some respects.
Oh, I agree. It's like talking to Grand
Safety-wise, anyway.
Everything progresses year on year, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And we've spoken about it so many times, is that the 1907 rider, the early days riders when they're on the goat tracks at the TT weren't trying any less hard than the lads in the 60s.
Nope.
Who weren't trying any less hard than DJ and Hickey today.
That's right.
But the roads have changed. You know, it's like an Axminster carpet on Sulby now and going out from Ginger Hall, which all improves speed. Your 130 club now is
and your bikes are that much quicker.
Yeah, so much more horsepower and stability and everything that goes with it.
Well, I mean, now I remember when we first started going there, anybody who did an 100-mile-an-hour lap, that was great.
Yeah.
But now you're aiming at minimum 125 as that's took over from the, or even slightly higher.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
I'm on about a newcomer going.
Yeah,
if
you
could do 125.
As a newcomer,
that's pretty good.
It is. Because then when you're moving on to that 130 now,
yeah,
I know sort of Pete and Dean and Michael are sort of 135, 136, but getting into that now 130 club, when you think that DJ did the first 125.
125, the lap record was 123.
Yeah, and he did 125, didn't he?
Yeah.
And then you think that's not all that, how things have progressed is...
It's crazy.
And we're going this year. We're going to go practice week Wednesday to the Saturday.
Yeah.
And
it's great practice week.
It's incredible.
I like it.
It's incredible. Are you going across this year? Are you going to make it?
I doubt it. Last time I went in, '17 I went practice week for a week. And it was great. Weather was great. And I went again in '18. And that was shocking.
It was.
Shocking. I never even went out on it. Just that
such
bad the weather. They did get some practice. It came not too bad in the evenings, but during the day and everything, it was horrible. You know, and you just don't want to be there then.
No. When you were running the teams, there was still morning practice and things, weren't they?
Yeah, it used to be good that getting up for that. But it was dangerous because that sun started coming up. There was quite a few fatalities and bad accidents because of that.
It's difficult, isn't it? And people don't realise that. I was talking to James Hillier about it, and a lot of the boys, if practice gets late in the afternoon, going through sort of Gorsley and out that way.
To Kirkmichael.
The flashing from the trees is so distracting because as the sun starts to drop.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine what it'd be like in the morning with just slightly a little bit of dew. You've got some half-asleep pigeons and rabbits pheasants.
Yeah, if you're first off.
Street sweeper, first one off. Not for me.
No, I mean, a lot of the riders, I mean, they did go out, but even then, I remember Jimmy Moody, he'd say, probably not go out, but have everything ready. I'll probably not go out. But then, quite many often, he'd end up going out, you know.
Because everybody else is. You can't replace bumming seat time.
No, that's it. Foggy went out when he was on our FSR 400. He went out. When he first came back to the TT, that'd be 93, weren't it? 93 was on the Yam against Easy, weren't it? Was it against Easy that
92?
Year? 92? Yeah, it might
92.
Be 92.
92 on the Izzy on the Norton and
because Yamaha said, can you run your 400? Which, you know, I said, yeah, not a problem. Like, so we took it over and he went out on that as his first ride back at the TT. Leach held the lap record on it at 108 and he went round at 111 in early morning practice. Come back, how is it? Yeah, it's all right. So the front just moves a bit in some places, but I can just bring that back up on my knee. And that was it then. Never heard anything from him again. He just carried on with Big Mike.
just to finish off, I speak to a lot of the riders that go to the TT and I talk about the Glen Crutchery Road. And it, from their perspective, as they go into no man's land, you've got the tap man, the most powerful man at the TT with the hand on the shoulder.
Yeah.
As a team manager and team owner, what's it like for you up on the Glen Road? What emotions are you going through?
Well, I mean, I think for anybody, you want to know, you know, your team's done its job right and they've been over everything, made sure the worst thing possible from a team point of view is a mechanical issue causing, not only just causing the rider to retire, but a possible accident. So that's that goes through your mind. And I mean, you know, you have to believe in your boys and I always cast my eye on things anyway. I used to do, you know. But then I leave them to it in pit lane. They don't want me there or Steve in pit lane, like, looking over them. We've done the rehearsal on that. It's up to them then. So, you know, I'll keep my eye on it, maybe for the grandstand. But me and Steve used to just sit behind the Aylward Centre on the forms, just listen to it. And then, as I was on the last lap, you wanted to see them coming through signposts. And then, especially if you're on for a result, it's like, oh, through signposts. And, you know, you start to relax a bit then. But it's, yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, I love the buzz of the place, absolutely. It's a tremendous feeling. And obviously then, you know, if you've got a result as well, it's superb. Super. There's nothing like it. It's so satisfying. It's like you win at a short circuit. Yeah, it's great. But like when you've won the TT, you've been there that length of time and put that sort of effort in and all the pressure which goes with it. In some ways, it's hard to explain because it can be quite relaxing, especially now with the modern machinery. Because if you've got a bike which you know is in the ballpark, like, yeah. I'm sure like somebody like Aiken goes back with the same bike.
Yeah,
he's confident enough if the roads are clear, he'll put a quick lap in straight away, and then he's just fine tuning it. I mean, back in the day when they had all the TZs and stuff, they were rebuilding engines, cranks. All sorts of sort of, you know, serious amount of work going on behind the scenes all the time.
Proper mechanicing almost in that sense, yeah, where they've got to change the engine internals.
Because he has to make sure everything was, you know, mileage properly and everything. But with the modern four strokes, they are easier to manage. You haven't got the pressure of tyres like you have on the short circuit. So you know what tyres you've got.
Yeah.
They don't wet in the wet anymore. There's none of that. There's no early morning practice. So, yeah, the pressure's still there, but I'm more relaxed at the TT than I'm on a short circuit. Sounds crazy, yeah. That, but it's wrong word to say easier. But if you've got the right rider and the right bike and you've done your job right, I think there's more pressure on the rider at the TT then.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got all your ducks in a row. Everything's there. Once that tap on the shoulder, it's down gone. To the rider. That's it. There's nothing more you can do.
You just go for a brew in the Aylward Centre. That's all you can do.
Because you know it's going to be 20 minutes before you see him again.
It's all good being, has he gone through, you know, you're all eyes up.
Glen Helen, sector by sector by sector.
Yeah.
It becomes a bit intense. But it's like, you've got 20 minutes now. I go, okay, he'll be back around. He's got two laps. You've got 40 minutes.
Yeah. You listen to it on the radio, you know.
Yeah, you know exactly what's going on.
Which is super special. That I love that TT radio. Yeah. It's just it's the accent and everything. It's
all of it, but it's a shame that they changed it. Last year was really difficult to listen to because the fella they brought in wasn't a TT man.
Yeah.
I can't remember. No disrespect or anything to him. It's what the TT brought in. Yeah. And I don't think it was right.
No. You need a Manx accent.
I think so.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than being thrown to Dave Kinley.
Yeah.
Into the Parc Fermé.
Yeah, yeah.
And then up and down the paddock. But then when you had Roy Moore and people like that who were out at the different posts and who's the other Boydie.
Yeah.
It's all necessary. It's all
it's great.
I mean, I love the YouTube side of things for the show. But the audio side, so for our audio listeners that are listening to this, we're sat in your lounge in Milner in Lancashire, but everybody listening has a completely different picture in their mind. And the same with the TT.
Yeah.
When you used to listen, when I was working at the old place and you'd be listening to it, you're there, you're picturing Balaf, you're picturing them coming through Glen Helen and Ramsey Hairpin. Right. And it's the old saying, it's theatre of the mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's some ways, it's a way to describe it because it's like, a bit like a podcast when that's on. I can be just, you know, you could be in a workshop, you could be working, you could be driving, and just listening to Manx radio. And the atmosphere. You just thought when I said with especially with the Manx accents as well, and it's you just I don't know, you get goose pimples.
It's that. Yeah, it's having the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and it's. I mean, the TV coverage has been next level, and it was fantastic last year. But for me, I love watching it on ITV4 of an evening when you know what's happened, and you know the Plater's on there, and Matt Roberts, and the rest of the team that put it together. At Greenlight,
Cameron,
and Cam Donald, fantastic addition.
I forget the name of the girl. The girl who they had this year wasn't too bad.
Grace Webb.
Yeah, she used to be on some of the car programmes.
Yeah, great. She was a bit for Triumph as well.
Very
good.
She comes over good. I mean, when they had that, she called Jodie Kidd. Shocking.
Yeah, not her fault, but she was thrust into something she didn't know what she knew nothing about.
And it wasn't her seeing that at all.
And you have to be have so much empathy being there and understand just what the whole event's about.
That's right.
Which... unless you've been and you've experienced it and you know the mindset of the riders and the teams, and it's go well, mate. Catch you later.
Yeah,
and it's a whole different world.
No, absolutely.
I love it. I certainly don't hate or loathe it, but I love it and don't love it in equal measure.
It's funny too because like I say with the riders, where you know you. Instead of the British Championship or whatever, they're a little bit more, what would be a bit more corporate how they're talking. TT, they don't give a shit, basically.
And that's exactly how it should be. It's just exactly how it should be.
Yeah.
Jack, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for having us over to your beautiful home. We will do this again. We'll do this again either late, maybe the TT. We get some stories out and we'll see you out and about, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'll be knocking about. I'll get to a few of the meetings and what have you.
Get to Alton Park and get you there. We'll get you a brew.
Yeah.
But Jack, thank you so much. What an absolute pleasure.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jack Valentine.
A huge thank you to Jack for inviting us into his lovely home and to his brilliant wife, Doris, for the much needed coffee. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did putting it all together and asking the questions. And well, in true off-track style, I've recorded this a couple of weeks in advance, so at this point, I don't actually know who next week's guest is. It could be anyone from four that we've got lined up for you at this point, so it'll be a surprise for me too. The one thing guaranteed is that there will be a show. And who knows, maybe Ben will return at some point if we've not managed to fit him in before now. So until next week, thank you so much for listening, and please do look after yourself. Bye-bye. This has been an Off Track podcast production in association with Graft Ventures.